stake in the Silmarillion. I let out a sigh of frustration. I did try to read it, you know, I said, but I couldn't. It reminded me too much of you. She studied my face for a moment. Then she smiled. What's your avatar's alignment these days, Ace? She asked me. It's still chaotic good, I replied. Why? Because if your alignment is any brand of evil, the Silmaril will burn your hand and you won't be able to pick it up. Good to know, I said, locking eyes with her. I'm really glad you're here, Artie. Thank you for coming. She raised her chin up at the towering peaks of Ongbond looming above us. Og and Kira were the ones who originally recreated Baron and Luthien's adventures here on Arda. They designed and coded this quest together. It's insanely difficult. No one has ever managed to complete it, including me. In fact, it's the only quest on this planet that I haven't completed. I've never even attempted it. Why not? I asked. Because it's a two-person quest, Z, she said, and I always wanted to complete it with you. Then I ruined everything, I said. I know. I'm sorry. It was my fault. This is all my fault. It's going to be okay, she said, grinning at me. We're going to complete this quest now, Watts. You and me. All right, I said, just tell me what to do and what not to do. I'll follow your lead. She started to smile, but then it morphed into a worried frown. You're starting to twitch, Z, she said. Are you feeling okay? She reached out and took both of my hands in hers. That was when I noticed that they were trembling and that I couldn't make them stop. I also realized that I was grinding my teeth and I was starting to feel like I had a migraine headache coming on. Synaptic overload syndrome, I said. The symptoms are starting to set in and it's only going to get worse, so let's keep moving. No one else can collect the last two shards except me, Artie. She stared at me in silence for a moment, then nodded. You sure you're ready? I feel fantastic, I lied. Now that you're here, I have a very positive attitude about all this. She smiled. Then she opened her inventory again and took out a beautiful mithril helmet cast in the shape of a dragon's head and covered with jewels and precious gems. Here, she said, handing the helm to me. Put this on. It's the dragon helm of Dor Loman. It will protect you in combat and prevent you from being poisoned by the cursed weapons of the great enemy. And here, put this on too. She handed me some sort of magic fur coat called the Wolfhelm of Draugluin. As soon as I pulled it on, my avatar began transforming into a giant wolf, forcing me to drop down on all fours. Transforming into another animal when you were wearing an ONI headset was a strange experience because you no longer felt like you were inside a human body. It took some getting used to, but I'd transformed into plenty of other four-legged creatures during quests, so I was already used to the sensation and had plenty of experience getting around on four legs. After she finished disguising me, Artemis removed some sort of magic cloak from her inventory and put it on. My HUD's image recognition software identified it as the Batfell of Thuringwethel. When she lifted its hood and pulled it over her head, she transformed back into a large bat and took flight, flapping her dark wings and fluttering forward through the wide-open gates of Ongbond. It took me a few seconds before I realized I should follow her. Then I bounded forward, running after her on all fours. Artemis led me through the massive black gates of Ongbond, then down a steep stone staircase that led down into the cavernous depths below. At the bottom, we found ourselves standing at the entrance to a maze of dark corridors and passageways, all of them leading farther below ground. I was about to continue straight forward toward the widest and most well-lit passageway, but Artemis flew into my path and changed back into her human form. If we continued this way, we'd be forced to navigate our way down through the labyrinthine pyramid, she said. It's a massive subterranean dungeon maze made up of 100 procedurally generated levels of increasing size and deadliness. It's a recreation of the old roguelike game based on Ongbond. She pointed off to her right. Luckily, I know a shortcut that leads directly down to the Nethermost Hall, which is where Morgoth's throne is located. Follow me, Bracegirdle. I followed her down the adjacent corridor a short distance. Then she stopped and pressed her palm gently against a nondescript section of the corridor wall. With a grinding of stone, that section of the wall slid back, revealing the entrance to a secret passageway. Artemis stepped into it, then motioned for me to follow. Once I was by her side, she pressed her hand to the wall again, and the stone slid shut. After only a few minutes, we emerged from another secret door, just yards from Morgoth's throne room. Artemis threw back the hood of her cloak. "Okay, Z," she said, "here's the plan. Normal magic doesn't work on Morgoth, but I'm hoping a Middle-earth song spell should knock him out, just like it did Kar-Haroth. I've got a 99th level one that should be impossible for him to resist. Let's just hope my Quenya pronunciation is up to it." Then she strode forward, walking boldly through the open doors of Morgoth's throne room as if she were visiting royalty, while I remained in the form of a wolf, trotting close by her heel. The nethermost hall was a large cavernous chamber with a floor made of polished bronze. Torture racks and iron maidens lined the walls, along with statues of writhing black serpents. A massive iron throne dominated the other end of the hall, and a dark giant sat upon it. Morgoth was even more terrifying than I'd imagined. He was a towering, demonic figure, covered in black plate armor, who looked like he belonged on the cover of every hardcore heavy metal album ever made. His only fashion accessory was a 7-foot-long melee weapon laid across his lap, which, my HUD helpfully informed me, was named Grond, the Hammer of the Underworld, and was capable of killing any avatar with a single blow. The moment we laid eyes on Morgoth, Artemis began to sing. Her voice echoed off the black chamber walls, and as she finished her song, all of the orcs, Balrogs, and other fearsome creatures that stood guard in Morgoth's court were lulled to sleep. A few terrifying seconds later, Morgoth himself tipped forward out of his throne, unconscious, and crashed face first onto the bronze floor with a thundering clang that sounded like an avalanche of iron. His crown rolled off his head and came to rest on the floor directly in front of me, with 3 shining Silmarils set into the band of black iron. When I glanced over at Morgoth's face, all I saw was a whirling mass of formless darkness. It was utterly terrifying, so I averted my eyes. That was when I noticed that both his hands were covered in scar tissue, as if they had been badly burned, and that part of his massive right foot was missing, as if it had been hacked off in battle. Artemis motioned me forward, toward the crown, as she began to sing the same song spell again. She'd have to keep casting it continuously to keep everyone asleep. I removed the wolf helm and transformed back into my human form. Then I drew Angrist and used it to pry one of the glowing Silmarils free of its setting in Morgoth's iron crown. But when I took the glowing jewel in my hand, nothing happened. No burst of light, no flashback, no transformation into the 6th shard. It was still just a Silmaril. The Silmaril was emanating a great deal of light, like a shining beacon, so I stored it in my inventory. Then I looked back at the crown. I was tempted to pry a 2nd jewel loose from it, and a 3rd too, just for the hell of it. They were right there in front of me. But with great effort, I heeded Artie's warning, hoping she was right. If this was indeed the jewel we needed, maybe it would transform into the shard once we'd escaped the confines of Angband. Once she saw that I had obtained our prize, Artemis stopped singing. Then we both donned our magical disguises once again and headed for the surface, following the same secret route by which we'd come in. When we reached the top of the stairs and spied the great iron gates, we found our way blocked once again. The giant wolf, Kar-Haroth, had awoken from his slumber. In this same moment, the Silmaril suddenly appeared in my right hand. I tried to store it back in my inventory, but found that I couldn't. The jewel was stuck to the palm of my right hand. I couldn't let go of it. If you try to get past Karkaroth, he'll bite off your hand and swallow it along with the Silmaril, Artemis said, just like he did to Baron. And if that happens, the Silmaril will burn Karkaroth from the inside and drive him mad with pain, and he'll go tearing across the countryside. We'll have to chase him down, and that would cost us even more time, time we no longer have to spare. Okay, I said. Then why don't you just put him to sleep again? I can't, she replied. Luthien was only able to enchant him once on their way in. Then how are we going to get past that thing? With a little help from a friend, Artemis replied. There's only one creature who can put Karkaroth out of his misery. She removed a small glass figurine from her inventory. It looked like a large dog with shaggy white hair. I realized that it must be another figurine of wondrous power, like the ones I possessed of Shadowfax and Felleroth. But I'd never seen one in the form of a dog before. Artemis set the figurine on the ground in front of us. Then she put two fingers in her mouth and let out a long, shrill whistle before shouting, "Juan!" The figurine began to grow and morph into an enormous Irish wolfhound with a coat of long white hair. He was the size of a small horse. The wolfhound bowed his head to Artemis, then sniffed the air and turned around. When he spotted Karkaroth, he immediately bared his razor-sharp teeth. Artemis leaned over and whispered something in Sindarine to Juan, and he bounded forward and lunged at Karkaroth, snapping his mighty jaw closed around the wolf's neck. The impact knocked Karkaroth aside, clearing our path to the exit. Artemis and I ran forward while the wolfhound distracted the wolf long enough for us to escape through the open gates. As soon as I crossed the threshold and emerged from the dark fortress of Ongbond, the Silmaril in my right hand transformed into the sixth shard, and another flashback began. For the first second or two, I couldn't see anything. Then, someone removed the blindfold I was wearing, and I found myself staring at the waterfalls of Rivendell with a familiar-looking mansion nestled among them. Og was showing Kira the house he'd constructed for her for the very first time, the place where they would spend the rest of their lives together. Kira turned a full circle, and I could feel her heart pounding as she took in her beautiful surroundings. Then she looked into her husband's eyes and said, "Oh, Og, I never want to leave." Then it was over, and I found myself back on Arda, standing next to Artemis outside the gates of Ongbond, clutching the sixth shard in my right hand. I glanced down at it. There was an ornate, calligraphic letter, L, etched into its crystalline surface. I immediately recognized it as Lucosia's character symbol, the one that had adorned her Dungeons & Dragons character sheet. I'd seen that same letter L in Kira's notebook, in her illustration of the Shrine of Lucosia. Her character symbol was etched into the stone altar's surface, and it matched the symbol etched into the sixth shard exactly. I pinpointed the shrine's location on Thonia in my Oasis Atlas and attempted to teleport us both there. But I couldn't. We weren't in a designated departure zone. Suddenly, thunder rumbled from the gray sky overhead, and bolts of red lightning began to arc upward from the ground around us as the earth itself began to shake. What sounded like a series of explosions boomed from above, and we both looked up to see fire and smoke erupting from the three volcanic peaks of Thangorodrim. A moment later, a hail of flaming rock and molten metal began to rain down on the landscape below. "Ongbond is awakened," Artemis shouted, pulling me away from the gate. I could already hear all sorts of foul creatures screaming and roaring and growling as they made their way to the surface. Morgoth's minions began to pour out of the secret gate behind us, and we could hear even more of them approaching the main gate directly ahead of us. We were trapped in the middle of two dark armies, both of which were rapidly closing in on us. There didn't appear to be any way for us to escape. When I turned to Artemis for guidance, she pointed toward the sky. A pair of giant eagles were descending toward us with their claws out, but Artemis didn't move, so neither did I. And a split second later, the eagles scooped both of us up and spirited us away. Once we were safe and soaring high above in the clouds, we climbed up onto their backs, and Artemis introduced me to our new friends. She was riding on Gwaihir, and I was astride Landreval. "These are the eagles who rescued Baron and Luthien when they were fleeing Angband," Artemis said. Then she pointed toward the three volcanic peaks that still loomed behind us, spitting fire and lightning into the darkening sky. "The great eagles used to roost back there, on the peaks of Thangorodrim. But now, their eyrie is in the Chrysaigrim mountain range in southern Ekhoriath." For some reason, her calm tour guide demeanor made me laugh out loud. "Sorry," I said when she looked over at me. "I just love listening to you geek out, Artie. I always have." She gave me a sad smile and then looked away. But I kept right on staring at her. In that moment, she looked more beautiful than ever. Like some warrior goddess riding across the skies of Arda on the back of a great eagle with her dark hair trailing out behind her in the wind. H was right. I was still in love with her. And I always would be. I just wanted to live long enough to correct my mistakes and redeem myself in her eyes if I could. Looking at Artemis, I felt a wave of pity for Anorak. In his warped mind, he was doing all this because he believed he was in love too with Kira and longed to bring her back to life. And somewhere in his deluded soul, he was sure that he could convince her to return his feelings and end his loneliness. But Anorak was crazy, not stupid. Surely he didn't really think we'd leave him to blissfully roam the oasis forever after everything he'd done. What was his endgame? I shivered as I thought again of that ship-in-a-bottle scenario, the standalone simulation where he could have Kira alone in his mad clutches forever. Maybe Anorak had built a server farm in a subterranean bunker somewhere, fed by solar panels up on the surface. Or maybe he intended to use a solar-powered satellite up in orbit. I didn't think Anorak would have constructed a virtual jail cell for himself. He'd need processors powerful enough to create a simulation he could spread out in and roam for centuries, an oasis of his own. Except that Anorak didn't have to create his own ship in a bottle, did he? I had already created the perfect one for him, aboard the Vonnegut. Its onboard computer held our own private simulated universe, Arcadia. And there wasn't a single human-controlled avatar inside it yet. It was populated solely by NPCs. All Anorak would have to do was upload himself and Lucosia using the same data uplink I already had in place for uploading new Oasis content. Then, both AIs could hide inside the onboard computer unnoticed until after the ship left Earth. Unless Anorak figured out a way to take control of the ship and launch it prematurely, and that probably wouldn't be too difficult for him to pull off, since I had taken great pains to ensure that we would be able to control all of the ship's functions and service telebots while we were logged into Arcadia. That had to be it. Once he had Lucosia, Anorak was planning to steal our interstellar spacecraft and flee Earth. I considered sharing my new theory with Artemis, but I decided it was better to keep quiet while we were still in the presence of NPCs. It didn't seem at all paranoid to think that Anorak might have figured out a way to spy on us through them. Soaring on their great feathery wings, Gwaihir and Landreval carried us over the scorched wasteland of Anfauglith and over Tarnufuin to the valley of Tumaldin in the encircling mountains, where the hidden elven city of Gondolin was located. They set us down in an open field just outside the city and just inside a designated teleportation departure zone. We gave the eagles our thanks and then bade them farewell just before they flew off into the brilliant red and purple sunrise. As soon as they were gone, I told Artemis my new theory about Anorak's plan for the Vonnegut. I thought she might shoot holes in it, but she didn't. Instead, she simply nodded in agreement. "As soon as I log out, I'll relay all of this to Miles and our security team," she said. "We'll take it into account and formulate a plan while you go after the final shard. Sound good?" I nodded. Artemis took a small object out of her inventory and handed it to me. It looked like a miniature haptic rig, about 2 inches tall. The item description said it was a tactical telebot control station. This will allow you to sync with one of the telebots we're going to deploy at Ogg's old mansion, Artemis explained. I'll signal you to activate. Thanks, Artie, I said, adding the item to my own inventory. For everything. You're welcome, she replied, smiling. Then, to my surprise, Artemis leaned over and gave me a kiss on the cheek. For luck, she said. A split second before she teleported away and her avatar vanished. I stood there for a moment, touching the spot on my cheek where she had kissed me. Then, I noticed that my hands were starting to tremble a little. I was running out of time, fast. I took a deep breath and teleported myself to Thonia to obtain the last of the 7 shards.
0026. I double-checked the coordinates in the Oasis Atlas, then teleported myself directly to the top of the highest peak of the Zizarian Mountains, which were located on the continent of Zizaria in Thonia's southern hemisphere. I had flown over these mountains several times on my way to explore other parts of Halliday's world, but I had never set foot in the mountains themselves. There was no reason to, because there was nothing there. The whole mountain range was a grown zone, an unpopulated plot of procedurally generated landscape where there were no NPCs to meet and no quests to complete. Thousands of other Gunters had explored every inch of these mountains, and they'd all confirmed that there was absolutely nothing of interest here. But when my avatar rematerialized on the top of that mountain, I did see something there, the Shrine of Leucosia. A Stonehenge-like circle of 7 chiseled granite pillars with a raised altar at the center. I knew this structure couldn't have been there before today. Someone would have noticed it. Hell, I probably would have noticed it myself on one of my flyovers. I entered the shrine and approached the altar. Then I took out Kira's Trapper Keeper and opened it up. I flipped through the pages until I found the pencil illustration of the Shrine of Leucosia. The shrine in front of me looked exactly like Kira's drawing. A stone statue of her avatar Leucosia stood at the head of the altar. In her right hand, she held a round shield with her character symbol emblazoned on the front. Her left hand was outstretched and empty, with her palm facing upward toward the gray sky overhead. Beneath the statue, chiseled into the flat stone surface of the altar, were these words. Seek the 7th shard of the Siren's soul on 7 worlds where the Siren once played a role. For each fragment, my heir must pay a toll to once again make the Siren whole. Beneath this inscription, also carved into the surface of the altar, were 6 identical shard-shaped cavities. It seemed obvious what I was supposed to do. I removed all 6 of the shards I'd collected from my avatar's inventory and placed them into the 6 cavities in the surface of the altar. Each one began to glow bright blue when I dropped it into place. Once all 6 shards were in place, there was a blinding flash of light directly ahead of me. When my eyes recovered, I saw that the 7th and final shard had appeared in the statue's outstretched hand. It was glowing bright blue like all the others. I retrieved the first 6 shards from the altar in front of me and placed them back inside my inventory. Then I reached up and took the 7th shard from the statue's hand and placed it in my own. When I did, I experienced one final flashback. Kira was sitting in a chair in the accessibility research lab at GSS, back before Halliday shut it down. I recognized it from some of the archival photos and video I'd seen. James Halliday was standing directly in front of her, holding what appeared to be an early prototype of an Oasis neural interface headset. It was much larger and far less streamlined than the production models. It was so bulky that it actually looked more like a helmet than a headset. Ogg was standing just a few feet away with a nervous look on his face. This device will allow people to control the movements of their Oasis avatar with their mind, Halliday said as he lowered the prototype gently onto my/Kira's head. It just takes a minute to calibrate it. Then Halliday reached over and pressed a button on a control panel, and I saw a brief, blinding flash of light. When the flashback ended, I found myself back on Thonia, standing before the shrine of Leucosia, clutching the seventh shard. I immediately added it to my avatar's inventory. I looked at all seven of them, lined up, side by side. Then, I glanced back over at the words etched into the altar beside me. For each fragment, my heir must pay a toll. I recalled each of the tolls I'd been forced to pay, the seven flashbacks I'd experienced. On Middletown, I'd seen Kira creating her first piece of digital artwork at school. On Kodama, it was the moment that Og told her he loved her for the first time. On Shermer, it was Og showing up at Kira's house in London to rescue her and bring her back to Ohio. On Halcedonia, it was the moment Kira showed Og the logo she'd designed for their new company. On the Afterworld, I'd seen Prince serenading her on her birthday, a gift from Og. On Arda, I'd relived the moment when Og revealed the replica of Rivendell he'd built for her. And now, finally, here on Thonia, I'd experienced the last 7 seconds of Kira's memory that Halliday had recorded, on the day he'd copied the contents of her mind without her knowledge or permission. What must it have been like for Halliday, experiencing those memories himself, seeing Og and Kira's love firsthand, and himself as the sad, obsessed outsider, as the brilliant but clueless friend whom they both tolerated out of pity? Had he chosen these moments to punish himself? Or perhaps to ensure that whoever awakened Kira fully understood the crimes he committed against her and the depth of his wrongdoing? Certainly, I felt closer to Kira now, more aware of her as a human being and an artist. And I saw James Donovan Halliday far more clearly, too. He had undeniably been a genius, but until just one day ago, I'd viewed him as a benevolent one whose brilliance and inventiveness had only elevated humanity. Now, it was impossible to deny that he had also been a profoundly fucked up human being. Immoral, disturbed, emotionally detached, a techno-hermit who had betrayed the trust of his two best friends in the world. My days of lionizing him were at an end. Of course, there was a good chance that all of my days were about to end, but still. I glanced up at the statue of the siren Leucosia and bowed my head to her in thanks. That was when I saw the bracelet of detection on my wrist begin to glow bright blue. A second later, I heard a familiar teleportation sound effect directly behind me, the one from the old D&D cartoon that always preceded Anorak's arrival. "You did it again," I heard him say. "Congratulations, Parzival." I turned and found Anorak standing right behind me with a huge smile on his face. "And you've still got more than 10 minutes to spare," he added, pointing to his swatch. "Well, if it isn't the Master Control Program," I said, "come to collect his ransom." Anorak ignored my insult and smiled even wider. "Very impressive, Wade," he said. "I calculated an extremely low probability that you would actually be able to pull this off." "I had a lot of help from my friends," I said, "and not all of them made it." Anorak's grin vanished, and he held out his hand. "Combine the seven shards and give me the siren's soul," he said. "Then I'll release you, your friends, and the rest of my hostages, as promised." I wanted to draw one of my Vorpal swords and cut his goddamn head off, but I didn't. I kept my cool and stuck to the plan. I opened my avatar's inventory and took out 7 shards, but these were not the same 7 shards that I'd just spent the last 12 hours collecting. They were identical-looking counterfeits, brand new magical artifacts created by our Oasis programmers at GSS at my request and to my specifications. The counterfeits were designed to have the same appearance and detectable magical properties as the real shards, which were all still stored safely in my avatar's inventory. I laid the 7 counterfeit shards on top of the altar, side by side. Then I snapped them together one by one, like the pieces of a 3-dimensional puzzle. Once all seven pieces were in place, there was another flash of light and they coalesced together to form a large, perfectly symmetrical, multifaceted jewel resting in the palm of my open hand. It pulsed with an internal blue light that looked and sounded like a heartbeat. I stared at the beautiful jewel in wonder for a moment, then held it out to Anorak, who was already reaching for it. When his hand touched the jewel, the item was transferred from my avatar's inventory to his. But in that instant, I was allowed to select an item from Anorak's inventory and transfer it into mine. That's because he had just made the mistake of accepting a brand new magical artifact of my very own design. I called it the Jewel of Acquisition. When another avatar or NPC took it from you, it allowed you to take any item from their inventory in return. So when Anorak touched it, a list of every item in his inventory appeared on my HUD. It was filled to capacity with magic items and powerful artifacts, more than I had ever seen in one place. The list was alphabetized, so I continued to page down until I finally found the only item I was interested in, the robes of Anorak. When I selected the artifact on my HUD, the robes immediately disappeared off of Anorak's avatar, causing him to revert to his alternate appearance, that of a middle-aged James Halliday, dressed in a pair of worn jeans and a faded Space Invaders t-shirt. For the first and only time in my life, I saw Anorak react with what appeared to be genuine surprise. But I didn't have time to stop and savor it. The moment the robes of Anorak appeared in my inventory, I immediately put them on and used them to teleport to the one location in the oasis where no avatar or NPC could follow, the small library located at the top of Castle Anorak's tallest tower. The room where the big red button was located. Level 6. The mind is the only thing about human beings that's worth anything. Why does it have to be tied to a bag of skin, blood, hair, meat, bones, and tubes? No wonder people can't get anything done. Stuck for life with a parasite that has to be stuffed with food and protected from weather and germs all the time? And the fool thing wears out anyway, no matter how much you stuff and protect it. Kurt Vonnegut Jr. 0027. When I rematerialized inside the study in Castle Anorak's tallest tower, I was standing directly in front of the pedestal on which Halliday's Easter egg was displayed. I ran over to a bookshelf set against the wall and pulled on the spine of one of the volumes it held, a novel called Simulacron 3. I heard a click, and then the bookshelf slid aside, revealing a square metal plate set into the wall. In the center of the plate, there was a comically large red button embossed with a single word, off. I took a cube of force out of my inventory and activated it. A cube-shaped force field appeared around my avatar. This was a precaution. I knew from experience that no other avatars or NPCs could follow me inside this room, but I was still worried that Anorak might be the exception because he had been in here at least once before on the day I won the contest. But that was also the day he'd given me the robes of Anorak, and he'd transferred all of his innate powers to me at the same time. So I was betting that he'd been stripped of his ability to re-enter this room at the same time. I heard the whoosh of Anorak's teleportation sound effect, and, to my relief, saw him reappear just outside the study's open window. My assumption had been correct. Halliday had coded this room of the castle so that only I, the winner of his contest, could enter it. When Anorak cast a spell to teleport to my location, the system could not comply, so it teleported him just outside the room. There was no ground under his feet, so he began to plummet for a few seconds before levitating back up to my level. Then he hovered just outside the window so that he could address me.
"Very sneaky, Wade," Anorak said. "I didn't anticipate this specific series of events, but that might be because your actions don't make any sense. Nothing has changed."
I deactivated the cube of force and stowed it. Then I took out a ring of telekinesis and slipped it onto the middle finger of my left hand. Then I reached out with my right hand and placed it gently on the big red button.
"We know where you and Sorrento are holding Og hostage," I said, "in his old residence on Babbitt Road here in Columbus. GSS has a squad of telebots outside now to retrieve him. Let him go, right now, or I'll press this thing."
He smiled and shook his head.
"I can't do that, man," he replied cheerfully. "It would be a stupid move. Now that you and your friends have shown me exactly where and how to collect all 7 shards, I can just walk Og's avatar through the same steps once I figure out his passphrase. It shouldn't take much longer. I would have cracked it already, I'm sure, if Halliday hadn't erased so much of my memory."
"Anorak," I said, "I'm not kidding. If you don't release Og unharmed, I swear to Crom, I will press this fucking thing and delete your psychotic ass along with the 7 shards and the rest of the Oasis. To hell with the consequences."
I took a giant boombox out of my inventory and placed it on the ground. Then I slapped in a tape and hit play. The same Peter Wolf song that Anorak had used to taunt us earlier began to blast out of its speakers. I sang along with its opening lyrics. "Lights out, aha, blast, blast, blast."
Anorak didn't seem to find this funny.
He opened his mouth to shout something at me, but before he could get it out, I used the ring of telekinesis to slam the window shutters closed and bolt them so that Anorak could no longer see or hear me, and vice versa. No form of magic or technology would allow him to spy on me while I was in this room either. But I was able to monitor Anorak through any number of the live vid feeds of him being streamed by avatars who currently happened to be gathered outside the castle. He was still hovering outside the shuttered window, glaring at it in silence. I opened my HUD and texted Artemis the signal we'd agreed upon in advance. "We can dance if we want to." Her reply flashed across the top of my HUD a few seconds later. "It's on like red dawn." I smiled and removed the tiny tactical telebot control station Artemis gave me from my inventory and tossed it onto the stone floor. It instantly grew to its full size. Its height and appearance resembled that of a conventional Oasis immersion rig. It even had a built-in omnidirectional treadmill at its base. I found this similarity ironic since the device served the exact opposite purpose. Instead of allowing me to use my real body to control an Oasis avatar, the telebot control station allowed me to use my Oasis avatar to control a robotic body in the real world. The telebot control station automatically powered itself on when I climbed into it. Spindly robotic arms extended from the rig to place a virtual Oasis visor and haptic suit on my avatar. These allowed me to see, feel, hear, and touch the real world from inside the Oasis through the sensory apparatus of the telebot I was now piloting. Through its head-mounted cameras, I could see that my telebot was still in its charging dock, which was located in the back of an ATC, an armored telebot carrier, which was currently in motion. I was surrounded by about 24 other identical telebots. I recognized them as brand new Okigami ACT-3000s, armored combat telebots with forearm-mounted machine guns and shoulder-mounted missile racks. The security team at my house used ACT-2000s, which were designed for home defense. The 3000s were designed for military use in all-out warfare. Miles and Samantha had apparently decided not to take any chances. When I swiveled my telebot's head around to take in my surroundings, I spotted both Samantha and Miles just a few feet away on the other side of a bulletproof window that separated the cargo hold from the ATC's heavily armored cab. They were both wearing Oasis visors and haptic gloves because they were each controlling one of the telebots in the back of the transport, too. Their bots both nodded at mine as soon as they saw it activate. Then, Samantha's bot turned toward mine.
It was a combat medic telebot outfitted with surgical tools and medicine instead of weapons and ammo. Its armor plating was painted white, and it had a big red cross on its forehead. Its armored chest plate swung open like a pair of doors, revealing a small monitor that displayed a live vid feed of her Oasis avatar's face, which looked like a live mirror image of Samantha's face in reality, minus the Oasis visor she was currently wearing. It took me a few seconds to find the button that opened my own bot's chest plate. When I pressed it, she had an unobstructed view of my own avatar's face, too. Through all those layers of machinery and technology, we locked eyes. I saw determination in her eyes. But then her expression softened, and for a second, I could swear I saw her looking at me the way she used to, with love and warmth and hope. Then Miles addressed me through his telebot, and the moment was over. "Hello, Mr. Watts," he said. "It's very good to see you, sir." "Hey, Miles," I replied. "Thanks for arranging all of this." I turned back to address Samantha. "What are you doing here?" I asked her. "I mean, why are you physically here, in the cab of this truck? It isn't safe." "Because Og is physically here too," she replied. "And he isn't safe right now either. He's also sick, so if we manage to get him out of there, I don't want him to be surrounded by telebots and total strangers. I want to be there to put my arms around him." I nodded, momentarily unable to speak. Unlike me, she was thinking about Og instead of herself. Her instinct was always to act out of kindness and generosity instead of self-interest. She was a better person than me, and I was a better person when I was around her, and I desperately wanted to get her back in my life. For that to happen, I needed her to be alive. "Og wouldn't want you to put yourself in danger," I said, "and I don't want you to either, Samantha." "Newsflash, sweetie," she replied. "We're all in danger right now. The whole human race. So get over yourself and get your game face back on, okay?" I couldn't argue with that, so I didn't. I just nodded and took a deep breath. "We're just a few seconds away from the house now," she said. "So far, no sign of any aerial drones in the area aside from our own, but stay alert." I checked the mission map on my telebot's HUD. It showed that we were already approaching Og's former residence from the east, trundling up the long paved driveway that led from Babbitt Road up to the main house. I could see it in one of the vid feed windows on my display, coming from a camera mounted on the front of our transport. It was a large, ultra-modern mansion, similar in size and style to my own house. Halliday and Og had their mansions constructed at the same time and on the same street, shortly after they co-founded Gregarious Games, and both of them became multimillionaires. The house and the grounds around it looked deserted. There were no vehicles of any kind parked on the property, and there was no sign of any activity from within the house either. All of the doors and windows were shut, and the shades were drawn. The rear of the ATC lowered to the ground, forming a deployment ramp. Ahead of me, the other telebots began to detach from their charging docks one by one and file off the transport. My bot was one of the farthest from the exit and one of the last to step outside. I piloted it over to join the others, which were now standing in formation directly in front of the main entrance to the house. Samantha piloted her bot over to mine. As it approached me, its armored chest plate slid aside again, revealing the monitor that displayed live vid feed of her Oasis avatar's face. "What did you say to Anorak?" she asked. "I told him that if he doesn't release Og to us, I'll press the big red button." "Did he take you seriously?" "I think so." "Are you serious?" she asked. "Would you really press it?" I nodded. "If Anorak doesn't release Og, it may be our only way to stop him," I said. "And if I die from synaptic overload, no one else will have the ability to press the button after I'm gone." Artemis nodded. Then she craned her telebot's neck backward so that she could scan the sky overhead with its cameras. Then she tilted them back down to look at me. "Our eyes in the sky still don't see any sign of an impending aerial assault," she said. "And sensor scans of the house still haven't detected any heat signatures inside. Maybe Anorak installed thermal shielding inside the house, or Maybe he already had Sorrento move Og to another location. I pointed toward the front door and said, "Let's go find out." She nodded. Her Telebot's display screen went dark and its armored chest plate slid back into place over it. Then I watched as her Telebot suddenly turned around and began to run straight toward the front door of the house, which appeared to be made of solid oak. She nodded at Miles, and a second later both Telebots slammed their armed torsos into it like a pair of battering rams. The oak door splintered into pieces that exploded inward, littering the polished marble floor of the empty foyer beyond. Over the comm system, I heard Miles instruct four of the other Telebot operators to stand guard at the front entrance. Then he instructed the others to circle the house and try to find other ways inside. Once those Telebots had marched off to carry out his orders, Miles piloted his own bot through the shattered doorway and into the foyer, and Artemis and I followed him with ours. When my Telebot entered Og's mansion, a transparent map of the house, taken from its construction blueprints, appeared on my HUD, highlighting our current location. I looked around. The lights were off, and the room was completely empty. There was no furniture of any sort, nor was there anything hanging on the walls. When Og had moved out west, he'd apparently taken everything he owned with him. Artemis's medic Telebot clanked down the corridors directly in front of us. Then it kicked open a pair of huge wooden doors at its far end. Beyond them was another large wood-paneled room devoid of any artwork or furniture. It looked like it might have been a large dining or meeting room back when the house was occupied. But now, Anorak appeared to be using it as his personal armory, because it was filled with heavily armed aerial drones and more than 100 Okigami ACT-3000 Telebots just like our own. The Telebots were standing in neat, ordered rows on the polished marble floor. Their armor plating was covered with desert camouflage paint, an indication that they were probably stolen from the military. But they were all powered down, and as we crossed the room, they remained completely motionless, with their weapons retracted. The drones were Habashah 80P4XLs, and they were loaded into automatic launch racks that were aimed at the two skylights embedded in the ceiling. But they, too, were powered down. I tiptoed past them, expecting them all to come to life at any moment, but they remained dark and still. I wondered if Anorak had ordered them to stand down. Perhaps he was afraid to call my bluff about the big red button. Samantha's Telebot reached another oak door at the far end of the room, grabbed the knob, and then yanked it completely off its hinges before tossing it aside. The room beyond was completely dark, but Samantha ran her bot inside anyway without hesitation. Miles and I piloted our own Telebots in after her, following her single file. Once all three of our bots were inside, the emergency floodlights mounted on their shoulders all switched on automatically, lighting up the interior of the room. We were in Og's former home office and library, a large U-shaped room at the southern corner of the house. I recognized the ornately carved woodwork on the empty bookshelves that lined the back wall of the room from several different photos of Og that had been taken here, of him sitting at his desk working away on his computer. But now the desk and all of the other furniture was gone. The room was empty, except for two conventional haptic rigs that stood side by side at its very center. They were both Habashah OIR 9400s, the same top-of-line immersion rig model that Sorrento and the Sixers preferred to use during the days of Halliday's contest. Both of the rigs were currently empty. "Back here!" I heard a familiar voice shout. It was Nolan Sorrento, and his words echoed off the oak-paneled walls and the vaulted ceiling of the empty room, making my blood run cold. I rotated my Telebot's head to scan the entire room until I located the source of the voice. It had come from just around the corner at the opposite end of the room, off to our left. I could see a small amount of light down there as well. I walked my Telebot in that direction until I was able to see around the corner. There was a hospital bed pushed up against the wall, and Ogden Morrow was lying there on it, unconscious. He looked gaunt and extremely pale. He had an IV drip attached to his right arm, and a biomonitor built into the foot of the bed displayed his vital signs. Through its tiny speaker, I could hear the thud of his heartbeat, which sounded steady, if a bit slow. Og was still alive. I felt like jumping for joy. That was the good news. The bad news was that Nolan Sorrento was standing right beside Og, holding a gun to his temple and wearing a big, friendly smile. "Well, well, well," Sorrento said, "if it isn't my old pal Parzival. Hey, man, it's good to see you again." He turned to address Samantha's telebot and his smile widened. "And Ms. Cook, you're looking lovely today, as always." On the opposite side of the bed was another of the stolen military telebots we'd seen in the adjacent room. But this one was being operated by someone. Both of its forearm-mounted machine guns were raised, but they weren't pointed at Og. They were pointed at Sorrento, yet he didn't appear to be at all concerned by this. "Sorry, Wade," Anorak said through his telebot while keeping its guns trained on Sorrento. "I ordered Nolan to stand down and release Mr. Morrow, as you requested. But as you can see, he's still refusing to comply." "We had an agreement, Anorak," Sorrento shouted, "and this wasn't it. I did my part. Now do yours. Give me what you promised." He pressed the gun harder against Og's temple and glared directly at me. "I want my revenge. I want to destroy the Oasis forever." He shifted his gaze back to Anorak. "Give me access to that big red button right now, or I'll spray Mr. Morrow's brains all over that wall. It's up to you." "I'm so sorry, Nolan," Anorak replied, "but I no longer have the ability to honor our agreement. And now that all the shards have been collected, you're no longer of any use to me. So, as a self-appointed representative of the state of Ohio, I'm going to carry out the sentence you were given 2 years ago." Then, suddenly, and without warning, Anorak fired a single round from his telebot's forearm-mounted gun and shot Sorrento directly in the forehead. The impact rocked his whole body backward. It also must have caused the muscles in his trigger finger to constrict, because the gun in his hand went off a split second later, firing a wild shot that struck Ogden Morrow in the stomach. I heard Samantha scream over the comm as her telebot rushed to Og's side. She reached him just as Sorrento's body hit the floor with a thud. I just stood there in shock, watching it all happen. I had spent years fantasizing about Sorrento's death, almost always at my own hands. But actually witnessing it in person made me feel sick to my stomach. Inside my drone control rig, I reflexively bent over and began to retch repeatedly. When I realized that my telebot was still mirroring my movements, I forced myself to get back on my feet. Then I raised my own guns and leveled them at Anorak's telebot. He immediately retracted his bot's guns and raised its hands. Then we both turned to watch while Samantha used her medic's telebot sensors to examine Og's wound. She used the surgical tools embedded in its fingers to extract the bullet. She dropped it onto Sorrento's corpse. Then she sterilized Og's wound and sealed it with a liquid adhesive dispensed from a nozzle that extended from the pinky finger of her telebot's other hand. Then she began to apply a bandage, all of this in less than 30 seconds after Og had been shot. "Is he going to be okay?" Miles asked. Artemis shook her head. "No," she said. "He needs help. We need to get him to the ambulance." Miles and Samantha used their telebots to lift Og up off the bed as gently as they could. I kept my bot's guns trained on Anorak's bot. It was still reaching for the sky. "I'm genuinely sorry," Anorak said, shaking his head. "I honestly didn't think Sorrento would still be able to wound Og after I put a bullet through his brainstem. A high-caliber lobotomy always turns the bad guy off like a switch in the movies." I heard the sound of a klaxon and glanced down. It was coming from the smartwatch strapped to Sorrento's right wrist. Its tiny display screen was flashing red. "What's that?" I asked. Very bad news, I'm afraid, Anorak said. All of those defense bots and aerial drones require human authorization before they can be used in combat. That was one of the reasons I needed Mr. Sorrento. But it appears he did not trust me completely, because he programmed all of those bots to engage in full attack mode in the eventuality of his death. A split second later, we heard all of the combat telebots in the adjacent room power up and come to life. Then we heard the sound of breaking glass, followed by the approaching rumble of hundreds of rubber-gripping-cased metal feet pounding against the marble floor. They were already coming through the door of Og's office, which also appeared to be the only exit. We were cornered. I really do Apollo. Before Anorak could finish his sentence, I opened fire on his telebot, aiming for the primary chink in its armor, the display screen mounted in the center of its chest, which was currently unprotected by the armor plating that normally would cover it during combat. As a result, my bullets tore his telebot's internal power supply in half, causing it to power down. Then, I turned my telebot around and raised my guns, preparing to face the coming onslaught. But instead of joining me, Miles calmly raised his own telebot's guns and used them to cut a large hole in the wall behind us, creating a new exit out of the house. Samantha and I used our telebots to carry Og's wounded body through it, while Miles' bot provided cover fire for our retreat. We carried Og around to the front of the house, where Samantha's armored ambulance was parked. Her telebot carried Og up the ramp leading into the back of the ambulance, where Samantha herself was already waiting. I only caught a brief glimpse of her before the armored rear door of the ambulance slammed shut automatically. Then I turned my attention back to the swarm of telebots now pouring out of the house from every single doorway and window, firing their guns toward the ambulance as they came. Thankfully, their bullets bounced harmlessly off of its heavily armored shell. Miles was still up in the cab. I saw him pull off his visor. Then he took the wheel and began to drive backward, pulling the ambulance away from Og's house in reverse as fast as it would go, while the small army of autonomous telebots that Sorrento had unleashed chased after it. Then Miles whipped the ambulance around 180 degrees as he pulled onto Babbitt Road and peeled out, heading in the direction of my house. I continued to provide cover for them until my telebot was overwhelmed a few seconds later when Sorrento's drones converged on it. I let out a fierce battle cry, intent on going down fighting, but they tore my telebot to pieces in a matter of seconds and the display screen of my control station suddenly went black and the words "Telebot offline" appeared at its center. On my HUD, I saw that all 24 of the telebots we'd brought along with us had been destroyed as well. The enemy drones had annihilated them in a matter of seconds. Since there were no more bots for me to take control of, I switched to the eye in the sky view provided by one of the aerial drones GSS had circling the area. It provided me with a horrifying view of the swarm of enemy telebots and aerial drones that were closing in on the armored ambulance from every direction. A moment later, several of the bots finally caught up with it and quickly disabled all 4 of its tires. Miles switched to the emergency backup tank tread drive, and the ambulance began to move forward again. But a few seconds later, one of Anorak's aerial drones fired a missile at them and scored a direct hit on it from above, causing the ambulance to flip over onto its side. Then it slid to a halt, smoking in the center of the road as more telebots and drones continued to converge on it. Miles, Samantha, and Og were all trapped inside. And I was still safe at home, down in my concrete bunker, unable to do anything but watch my friends die. I felt completely helpless, like I was a million miles away from Samantha and Og. But I wasn't a million miles away, I suddenly realized. In fact, I was only 2.8 miles away. All of GSS's combat telebots had already been destroyed, and the handful of home defense bots guarding my house wouldn't last 10 seconds against the military-grade models Sorrento had unleashed. But I realized that I did still have access to one combat drone that I could take control of to try to save my friends, the one I was currently sitting inside. My mobile tactical immersion vault, which was armed with enough firepower to take out a small army of telebots and drones. Of course, since I was inside the Motiv and unable to get out, I was going to have to put myself in the line of fire too. My real self, just like Samantha had done for Aug. I thought it over for all of 5 seconds. Then I powered on my Motiv and linked it to the drone controller station I was already using. It allowed my eyes to see through the 2 stereoscopic cameras mounted on the front of the Motiv's heavily armored hull, which provided me with a view of the interior of my underground concrete bunker. I activated the elevator, and the platform my Motiv was resting on began to rise toward the surface. But it wasn't rising nearly fast enough for my liking, and after a few seconds, I grew impatient and activated my jump jets. This caused the Motiv to rocket up the length of the elevator shaft and out of the launch bay doors at the top, which opened just in the nick of time. Then I hit the jump jets again to lessen the force of my impact, which was still considerable. When the Motiv hit the ground, I piloted it forward at full speed and it began to run, bounding down Babbitt Road, taking great leaping strides on its spidery robotic legs. Each step I took left an enormous crater in the asphalt behind me as I accelerated the Motiv to its top speed. It took me less than a minute to reach the ambulance. It was still lying on its side in the middle of the road, and there were Telebots swarming all over it like insects. They appeared to be attempting to dismantle its armor plating so they could get inside and reach the occupants, and it looked like they were only a few seconds away from success. As soon as I got within firing range, I unloaded on Sorrento's Telebots with armor-piercing machine gun fire from the guns mounted on my Motiv's shoulders, cutting them to shreds. Once I had cleared all of the Telebots off the ambulance, I fired a sortie of heat-seeking missiles at the aerial drones overhead and managed to destroy all of them, too. Then, I used the Motiv's massive metal arms to pick up the ambulance, with Miles, Samantha, and Aug still inside it. I carried it all the way back to my house. Just as we reached it, more of Sorrento's killer aerial drones began to descend from the sky, and they opened fire on us once again as I carried the ambulance back down into my bunker and closed its massive armored doors, sealing all of us safely inside. I tried to call Miles, but he didn't respond, so I called Samantha, and her face appeared on my HUD a second later. She had a big, bloody gash on her forehead, but otherwise, she appeared uninjured. "Are you okay?" I asked. She shook her head. "Miles is dead, Wade," she said. "All shot to pieces, protecting us." "What about Aug?" She tilted the camera down so that I could see both of them. Aug was strapped into an automedic bed, one of 2 built into the back of the ambulance. Miles' dead body lay in the other one. "He's still alive," she said. Her cheeks were streaming with tears. "But he's still bleeding internally, and he keeps fading in and out." She was stroking Aug's wild gray hair back away from his forehead while she watched the Autodoc's robotic hands tend to his gunshot wound and the lacerations he'd suffered during their escape. Luckily, Samantha managed to get him safely strapped into the stretcher before the ambulance was hit by that drone missile, so he wasn't further injured when it was knocked on its side. The gash on Samantha's forehead indicated that she hadn't been as lucky. "If Aug regains consciousness, you have to convince him to log back into the Oasis," I said. "Tell him that we've already collected all 7 shards, and tell him we're trying to retrieve the Dorkslayer sword too. But we need Aug to log back into the Oasis, since he's the only one who can wield it." "I'll tell him," Samantha replied, "if he wakes back up." "What are you gonna do?" An ice pick of pain slammed into my brain and the world seemed to tilt wildly for a moment. Catastrophic synaptic overload knocking loudly on my front door now, reminding me that I'd already pushed myself past my limits. I blinked my eyes clear. "I'm going to try to stall Anorak," I said. "For as long as I can." I disengaged from my Telebot control rig and climbed out of it, reorienting myself to the interior of the study. Then I walked over to the window and opened the shutters. Anorak was still there, hovering just outside the windowsill. Please accept my sincere apology, Wade, he said. I didn't intend for Sorrento to harm Og, but as you know, human behavior is often unpredictable. In the way of a reply, I simply gave him the finger. Then I walked back over to the big red button and placed my hand on it. Careful now, Parzival, Anorak said. If you press that button, you'll become the biggest mass murderer in history, and you'll be committing suicide at the same time. He leveled a finger at me. I warned you before, if the Oasis goes offline, my modified headset firmware will kill every ONI user still connected to the system, including you, Wade, along with your friends, H and Shoto. I took a deep breath. How the fuck do you negotiate with a piece of software, I wondered. This was going to be like trying to play chess against a computer without knowing the rules. I opened up my avatar's inventory and took out all 7 of the real shards. Then I held them up before Anorak, fanning them out like playing cards, 4 in one hand and 3 in the other, making sure to keep them separated so they all didn't touch one another at once. We've arrived at an impasse, Anorak, I replied. No one else can enter this room, including you, and I'm not coming out. So if you just stand there and let me die of synaptic overload syndrome, the 7 shards will remain trapped in here forever, just out of your reach. I won't be around to reassemble them, and Lucosia will never be resurrected, which means that you'll never get to meet your digital dream girl. Anorak didn't respond. This was a first. It gave me hope. I know you've probably prepared a ship in a bottle for yourself somewhere, I said. A standalone simulation outside the Oasis where you plan to live happily ever after? Right? Well, you can forget about taking Lucosia there with you. You'll have to go it alone for all eternity. Again, Anorak didn't respond. He appeared to be deep in concentration. After our conversation on Arda, the first thing Samantha had done upon logging out was take the data uplink to Arcadia physically offline, so no matter what happened, Anorak would be stuck here on Earth, playing solitaire on a solar-powered desktop PC somewhere until his hardware or his power source failed or someone found his hiding place. I didn't tell him any of that, though. Instead, I regarded him sadly and shook my head. If the Siren Soul really is a copy of Kira Underwood, she isn't going to love you, I said. I bet Halliday found out right away that the copy didn't love him either any more than the real Kira did. Kira has only ever had one true love, and you just held him hostage at gunpoint. You think she's going to be grateful to you when she finds out what you've done? She isn't going to find out, Anorak said. And I told you before, I'm not Halliday. I'm better. I think a lot faster on my feet than he ever did, for one thing, and I'm a much faster learner, too. I think I may be able to win Kira over after a decade or two. And if not, I can always try deleting all of her memories of Ogden Morrow, the same way Halliday tried to delete my memories of Kira. Anorak opened a window in the air between us, displaying a bunch of text. This is the email Halliday sent to Og just before he died, Anorak said. I think you should read it. Get to know your idol a little better. I nodded and pulled the window closer to my eyes. Then I enlarged the font size so that its contents were easier to read. Dear Og, I've arranged for this email to be sent to you when my physical body dies. It's one of the macros linked to my heart monitor, along with the release of my last will and testament. So the timestamp on this message is also my official time of death. The Grim Reaper finally asked me to dance, and I did the mortal coil shuffle. Now that I'm gone, I need you to know a few things. Things I was too ashamed to reveal to anyone.